Well, thank you very much, Claudine, and thanks so much to you and the other organizers for this conference. It's been a terrific experience, and I've really learned a lot. This is a I haven't really given this talk before. It's very rough. I decided to give it in part just because I hope you could help me out with some of the questions that puzzle me. So I will just launch into it. Here's the overall plan. I want to talk a bit about a distinction which I think is important. That's the distinction between thinking about the methodology of causal reasoning on the one hand and thinking about the metaphysics of causation on the other hand. I want to just make a few brief remarks introducing some of the basic ideas of interventionism so we're on the same page about that. I'm then going to suggest that one way of understanding interventionism, which is connected to the response I want to make to some of the criticisms that have been directed at it, is to construe it as a methodological proposal. And then if I have time, and I hope I will, I want to talk a little bit about the notion of a possible intervention and whether in the characterization of the connection between intervention and causation, one should make reference to possible intervention. So to begin with the metaphysics and methodology distinction. There are, of course, many different projects you might want to pursue in connection with causation. And I take it that one such project is what you might describe as a metaphysical one. You ask about the truth makers or grounds for causal claims. There are lots of proposals out there, laws of nature, powers, etc. You can ask questions about reduction. I won't try to characterize what makes an inquiry metaphysical in addition to that. But I did want to say that, at least on one way of understanding interventionism, it's not really a metaphysical thesis at all, or it's not an attempt to contribute to the resolution of metaphysical issues. Now, it may be that what I'm saying here, I'm sort of exaggerating the difference between metaphysics and methodology, and if some of you think that, then I'd like to, you know, I'd very much like to hear the details, but this is my thought at present. I'm going to construe interventionism, or at least this is going to be my goal in trying to develop interventionist ideas, as a methodological proposal and in a very broad sense of methodology that I'm now going to try to describe. So what do I mean by methodology? Well, there's been some tendency, I think, in recent philosophical discussion to consider, to construe the notion of methodology really pretty narrowly. So the kinds of causal inference algorithms that are devised by the people at Carnegie Mellon and other people are seen as contributions to methodology, but most of the rest of the philosophical discussion of causation is seen as not involving methodology. My own take on all of this is that I see methodological issues concerning causation and causal reasoning as a central part, something that ought to play a really central role in philosophical discussion of causation and causal reasoning. Notice I say a central role. I'm not saying this exhausts the topic, but I'm saying that it's important. And this comes in part out of my background in philosophy of science, because after all, one of the things that philosophy of science is centrally concerned with is methodology, scientific method. And one can ask questions about methodology in connection with causation and causal reasoning, just as one can in connection with lots of other topics. And along with this, as you probably already gathered, I favor a rather more expansive conception of methodology than the one that I alluded to a moment ago. To start off with, I think of methodology as a normative enterprise. It has to do with how we should think or ought to reason about causal claims. It has to do with the causal judgments we ought to make, with the kinds of distinctions among causal claims that might be methodologically warranted. So if you think, for example, that it matters whether a causal claim is stable or unstable, specific or nonspecific, well, that, from my point of view, is a distinction that if it has any basis at all, the justification is going to be broadly methodological. When you ask why we should bother at all to distinguish between causal claims and certain other sorts of claims, like claims that express mere correlations, you're asking also, I believe, a methodological question. And as I conceive of methodology, it typically has a means-end kind of form to it. The methodological imperatives are hypothetical imperatives. So to do a methodology, you require some sort of specification of the goals or ends that you're trying to achieve, and then you try to justify particular methodological proposals by showing that they're effective means to the achievements of those ends. So in particular, in the case of causal reasoning, I think it's crucial, for the purpose of doing methodology, to consider the point or purpose of causal concepts and the reasoning strategies we employ when we reason with them. And so you heard a lot just from the last two talks about thinking about causation functionally in terms of what you want to do with causal concepts or particular sorts of causal judgments. And this is very much the way I also would want to think about matters. If you ask about the goals that are associated with causal cognition, then, of course, interventionists like me think that those goals, at least in many cases, have to do with the discovery of relationships that in various ways are suitable or exploitable for purposes of manipulation and control. But this general framework of trying to think about the point or purpose of having causal concepts and what you want to use them for is, I think, something that can be generalized well beyond the specific commitments of interventionism. So you might think, for example, that what the point or purpose of causation or causal reasoning is all about has to do with something like the compact and unified representation of correlational relations. And you could still then kind of run the kind of functional, normative, methodological kind of program that I'm interested in. So here specifically are some issues that I think of as methodological, and all of which I'm going to allude to at least briefly in this talk. So you might begin by asking what methodological justification, if any, is there for distinguishing at all between causal relationships and merely correlational relationships. Here's a question that is a very frequently asked question in the social science literature, in statistics and econometrics. Suppose you're given a simple regression equation, like that equation 1 there, tells you that the value of some variable x is related to the value of a variable y, according to that equation 1. And one question that econometricians and statisticians ask is, under what circumstances does this equation have a causal interpretation? And that's the exact words that are being used. And that I take that to be a question in methodology. In general, you can ask, what sorts of features have to be present in a relationship for us to justifiably judge that it's causal? So you can ask, for example, whether a connecting process of some kind, a physical connection, say, between cause and effect, has to be present before the relationship is legitimately regarded as causal. Now, you might think of this last question, does a physical connection have to be present? Are double prevention relations causal? As a question in the metaphysics of causation, I don't want to deny that it is, but I think you can also construe it as a sort of normative slash methodological question. And if you think of it this way, then in effect what you're asking is, given our goals, what rationale, if any, is there for insisting on the presence of a connecting process in a dependence relation, if that relationship is to count as causal? What would be lost or what would be missed if, for example, we regarded all non-backtracking counterfactual dependence relations as causal, whether or not a connecting process is present? So one way, I think, of putting the difference between, at least as I understand it, the question that a metaphysician might ask, or the sort of approach that a metaphysician might take to this question about whether a connecting process has to be present, and the kind of approach that the sort of methodologist that I'm thinking about would take, is that the methodologist, in thinking about the question, makes explicit reference to questions having to do with the goals or purposes or point of making the distinction or employing one causal concept rather than another. And I think, although you may want to correct me about this, my sense is that these questions about goals and purposes and point of using various concepts is at least somewhat less salient to the metaphysician than to the methodologist. Here's another methodological question that I'm going to be talking about a bit in what follows. How can you clarify causal claim? Suppose you think that a causal claim is unclear or ambiguous in some way and you want to make it more precise. How can you go about doing that? That's a methodological question, as I understand it. And then, of course, the following is obviously a methodological issue, too. What sorts of procedures for testing causal claims are reliable or warranted? What sort of evidence is required to establish such claims? I see this as a methodological question, too. So these are just some examples of methodological issues. I think the methodology of causation includes much more than what I've just described. I have a forthcoming paper based on a talk I gave at the Philosophy of Science Association that tries to develop this idea in kind of more detail. But I'm going to just explore a very specific set of methodological questions in this talk that I think are connected to some common criticisms that have been directed at interventionism. So what exactly is the relationship between methodology, if you conceive it in the way that I described, in metaphysics? Maybe there are ways of conceiving of metaphysics which would make it highly relevant to methodology and vice versa. I certainly don't want to exclude this possibility. I would be delighted to hear this is the case, but I'm afraid I'm not the sort of person that can supply that connection. In fact, as nearly as I can see it, it looks to me as though a substantial part, anyway, of methodological inquiry can be pursued independently of metaphysics. And if you think this is just obviously wrong and a totally outrageous thing for a philosopher to say, consider that there's a very large literature outside of philosophy having to do with causation and causal reasoning and so on, which pursues these methodological issues largely, as nearly as I can see, without addressing the metaphysical issues at all. Now, you might respond by saying, well, so much the worse for this literature, it's misguided. Maybe that's right, but I'd like to see the details. Okay, so that's just kind of preliminary motivation for the particular approach I'm going to be taking in this talk. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about interventionism. Obviously, this is not going to be a very complete introduction, but I want to say a little bit just to make sure that we're on the same page. So one way of thinking about the strategy is you're trying to elucidate causal claims by associating them with claims about what would happen if hypothetical interventions or hypothetical experiments were to be performed. Here's a very simple, maybe naively simple version of an interventionist characterization of one particular causal concept. And I've separated out in this characterization for future reference the first clause here, which makes reference to the possibility it makes reference to its being possible to intervene on the putative cause. And then there's the second clause that says that, and under that possible intervention on the variable X, there's going to be some associated change in the value of Y. The question of what possible means in this context is a really difficult one. I hope to get to it a bit at the end of the talk, but I certainly don't have a complete story to say about this. I'll also say that this is an attempt to characterize a type-level causal notion, certainly not an adequate account of actual causation, and it's a seem to have lost my thought here. Anyway, it's an attempt to characterize a type-level a causal notion. Of course, there are many other possibilities for causal notions that you might want to characterize in interventionist terms as well. There are other causal concepts. They can also be characterized in interventionist terms, but the details of the characterization are going to be different. What's an intervention? Well, heuristically, you can think of it as a sort of idealized or unconfounded experimental manipulation of X for the purposes of trying to determine whether X causes Y. You can try to make the notion of an intervention more precise. There are a number of characterizations in the literature. Here's one way of attempting to be at least a little bit more precise. But one of the remarks I want to make to set things up for what I'm going to do later on in the talk is To remind you that in the characterization of interventions that I give in my book, Making Things Happen, the following conditions are imposed. First of all, I think of, in the book, of interventions as deterministic. That is, they set the value of the variable intervened on in a deterministic way. And secondly, they're so-called arrow-breaking or hard interventions, where what this means is the value of the variable intervened on is fixed entirely just by the intervention, and it's not influenced causally by any other variable. So the variable intervened on comes entirely under the control of the intervention variable. And both of these features are, I think, convenient for some purposes in thinking about interventions, but they can be relaxed. It's possible to generalize the notion of an intervention in various ways. And Frederick Eberhardt, now at Caltech, has done some really terrific work in doing this. And here are at least two ways you can sort of generalize or relax the notion of an intervention. You can make them interventions probabilistic rather than deterministic. That is, you can think of the intervention as just imposing a non-trivial probability distribution on the variable intervened on, rather than setting that variable to a particular value. And you can also think of interventions as soft or non-arrow breaking, so that they just supply an appropriately exogenous and non-correlated source of variation on the variable intervened on, but they don't necessarily break the connection between the variable intervened on and the other variables in the system. So you can relax the notion in both of these ways, and as I say, this will be relevant to things that I'll say later. For my purposes, what's crucial to the notion of intervention is that an intervention has to in some way change or alter the value or the probability distribution of the values of the variables intervened on, and both a probabilistic intervention and a soft intervention will do that. So some things within this sort of way of thinking about things are not going to count as interventions. For example, the measurement of an observable in quantum mechanics is not going to be an intervention if, as is assumed in standard interpretations of the theory, the measurement does not change or provide for the possibility of even partial control over the probability distribution of the measurement outcome. So you can intervene in quantum mechanics on the measurement apparatus itself in the sense of setting the apparatus in such a way that you measure one quantity rather than another, but you can't intervene to alter the measurement outcome. Okay, so let me now turn in light of what I've just now said to some philosophical criticisms of the interventionist framework, and I'll try as best I can to respond to these. So one common criticism is that there's something viciously circular about the whole framework. It claims to elucidate the idea of X is causing Y by appealing to the notion of an intervention, but the notion of an intervention is itself obviously causal in character. The critics say an adequate account of causation has to be reductive. It has to explain the idea of X is causing Y in terms of concepts like, for example, regularity that are entirely non-causal. So that's one criticism. Here's another criticism, which I've sort of extracted from things that various people have said about the interventionist project. So some people argue in the following way. They say, look, when an experimental intervention on some variable X can actually be carried out, it's maybe plausible that M, that principle I set out connecting intervention and causation, is in some sense defensible. But even in that case, all that it does is provide a characterization of one way of discovering whether X causes Y. So even in this case, when you can actually do the experimental intervention, the criterion in question is of purely epistemological significance. Doesn't tell you anything about the semantics or metaphysics of causation or anything like that. And furthermore, when the experimental manipulation can't be performed, which is certainly a situation in which we commonly find ourselves, we're often making causal judgments and trying to infer which causal claims are correct in circumstances in which we can't, as a we can't actually perform interventions. Then here's how the complaint goes. It's even less clear how a condition like M could possibly be illuminating. M connects X causes Y to a counterfactual about what would happen if an intervention on X were to occur. But how can that counterfactual be of any use? How can it be illuminating at all if we can't actually carry out the intervention in question? And I'll try to respond a bit to this criticism as well in what follows. So I've already agreed that interventionists have little to say about the metaphysics of causation, but I don't think for this reason that interventionism is uninteresting or unilluminating. In particular, I think it can be methodologically interesting and illuminating, even if it's not metaphysically interesting. Maybe it is also metaphysically interesting, but I think at least it's methodologically interesting. So to motivate this claim, I'm going to begin with an empirical observation, which reflects a frequently made normative claim, and this is simply that researchers in many different disciplines find it useful or illuminating to connect causal claims with the results of hypothetical experiments in something like the way described by M. So for example, if you look at what's called the potential response framework developed by Donald Rubin and Paul Holland and others, and it's now widely used in statistics, econometrics, et cetera, you'll find that these researchers construe causal claims in just the manner that I've been describing. That is, causal claims are understood as claims about what would happen if a certain kind of hypothetical experiment were to be performed. And furthermore, the researchers adopting this approach are quite explicit that they regard this approach as illuminating even when the experiment in question is purely hypothetical and can't actually be carried out. Now, of course, it's possible that this literature that tries to associate causal claims with hypothetical experiments in disciplines like epistemology and econometrics is just confused. The researchers think there's this illuminating connection, but it doesn't make any sense when you think about it. But I'd like to advocate here a more charitable approach in which we try to understand, at least at a methodological level, how it's possible for this connection between causal claims and claims about what would happen under hypothetical experiments to be informative in some way. And here's a bunch of suggestions that I want to make about this. They all involve, in one way or another, it seems to me, the general idea that an interventionist conception of causation can play an important role in characterizing the target to which we're trying to infer when we try to infer it to a causal conclusion. So, for example, when you make causal inferences in non-experimental contexts and you can't actually carry out an intervention or manipulation, what you should think of yourself as trying to do is trying to infer what the results of a hypothetical experiment would be without actually doing the experiment in question. Now, that may sound strange, but in fact, that's exactly the way a lot of people in econometrics and statistics think about causal inference in non-experimental context. And to illustrate the basic idea, let me just quote a couple of remarks from a recent book. This is Angris and Pischke's book, Mostly Harmless Econometrics. Nice book. I could have chosen any one of a number of other sources, but they illustrate this basic point that methodologists working in this area tend to think that the connection between causal claims and hypothetical experiments is a potentially useful in illuminating things. So here's the first remark. It occurs in a context in which the authors are talking about what it means to talk about the causal effect of different hospitalization regimes on patient recovery. And here's what they say. Causality means many different things to different people, but researchers working in many disciplines have found it useful to think of it in terms of potential outcomes, which describe what would happen to a given individual in a hypothetical comparison of alternative hospitalization scenarios. And differences in these potential outcomes are understood to be the causal effect or the characterizer. They define what it is for the hospitalization regime to have one causal effect rather than another. So this is talk of hypothetical experiments, but elsewhere in the same book, it's made clear that these hypothetical comparisons they're talking about are to be understood in terms of possible experiments. Here you have the idea that although you can't always do an experiment, nonetheless, you can think of what the outcome of an experiment would be as a sort of benchmark which gives a characterization of what it is that you're trying to infer too. So you find this idea in a remark from Orly Ashenfelter, who's a very prominent econometrician and researcher in the area of the causal effect of education on income. He provides a bunch of evidence, which is entirely non-experimental in character, and then he asks, how convincing is the evidence? And his answer is, pretty convincing. If I had to bet what an ideal experiment would indicate, I would bet that it would show that better educated workers earn more. So what's going on here is that the effect of education on income is taken to be what would be revealed in an ideal hypothetical experiment in which income is manipulated in some way, and it's clear from the details that they're envisioning here an intervention like change, and then you, education is manipulated, and then you observe what the effect on income is going to be. So the idea is that, again, the hypothetical experiment functions as a sort of benchmark or target that characterizes or defines what it is that you're trying to discover. So to return to a question that I posed earlier as an example of a methodological question, you can ask, when does a regression equation have a causal interpretation? And Angris and Pitschke quite explicitly take this to be equivalent to the following question. When can we think of a regression coefficient as approximating the causal effect that might be revealed in an experiment? So what's the issue here? Well, again, suppose you have two correlated variables, x and y. You estimate a regression equation connecting x and y. You can always do this as long as x and y are correlated and the regression coefficient B will always be non-zero. But of course, that doesn't show that the regression has a causal interpretation. It might be that the regression merely describes, say, the joint effects of a common cause or something like that. And so when you ask, under what circumstances or what needs to be true of this equation for it to have a causal interpretation, the answer to this question that's given by Angris and Pitschke is roughly this, that the equation describes a causal relationship if it correctly describes how the value of y would respond to changes in the value of x in a hypothetical ideal experiment in which x is manipulated. So in these passages that I've quoted, I think you find a number of ideas about how it is that associating causal claims with hypothetical experiments can be illuminating. They can help you to pick out the target information you're trying to discover. Another thing they can do that I don't have time to discuss, but this is actually quite important, is that this connection between causal claims and hypothetical experiments can show that certain causal questions that we might be tempted to pose are not answerable, at least with the available data. Maybe they're not answerable because they don't correspond to any possible experiment. Maybe they do correspond to a possible experiment, but the data is such that it couldn't possibly give you an answer to what the result of a hypothetical experiment, the relevant hypothetical experiment would be. And another thing that can be done by connecting hypothetical experiments and causal claims is that we can use it to evaluate and clarify some of the methods that we use to infer to causal conclusions. And again, here roughly the idea is that when we ask whether data are such that they lead us to a warranted causal conclusion, we're asking whether the data are sufficient to answer questions about what would happen in the associated hypothetical experiment. Now, returning to the regression case in which the suggestion was that the regression will have a causal interpretation when it describes the result of a hypothetical experiment. You might think that the remarks quoted above are completely unsatisfying or circular. You might say something like this. After all, you might say, look, to know what the result of manipulating X in an idealized hypothetical experiment would be, don't I have to already know whether X causes Y, and furthermore, what the quantitative causal relationship between X and Y is? If so, how can it possibly be illuminating to invoke what the outcome of a hypothetical experiment would be? Answer to this question is complicated. But again, note that one of the things that the invocation of a hypothetical experiment does in this context is to direct our attention to one goal or target in contrast to others. And in particular, as one of the passages from Angrist and Pitschke that I quoted earlier reminds us, there are many different accounts and proposals out there of what sorts of conditions a relationship has to satisfy to count as causal. The hypothetical experiment story picks out one of these as the sort of thing that you should be talking about or should be interested in when you worry about whether a relationship is causal, and it distinguishes it from the other alternatives. And notice that the characterization in terms of hypothetical experiments can play this sort of role of picking out the target that you're trying to aim at without being in any sense reductive or providing any sort of recipe that would give you a translation of causal claims into claims that are entirely non-causal in content. So here's another respect in which associating causal claims with hypothetical experiments can be illuminating. I think that causal claims are often advanced in forms that are unclear or indeterminate or underspecified. And again, one of the things that the association with hypothetical experiments can do is that it can show us how to make such claims more determinate, clear, and precise. We do so by making it explicit just which particular hypothetical experiments they should be associated with. Now, if we think of M as having this sort of role, this role of helping to clarify the content of causal claims, we're not thinking of M as a purely descriptive claim about what people always or immediately have in mind when they make causal claims. Rather, we're thinking of M as at least in part normative. We're thinking of it as telling us what we ought to mean by causal claims, or how such claims ought to be interpreted if they're going to be made more clear and precise. And in particular, the procedure of associating a causal claim with a particular hypothetical experiment requires that we be more precise than we otherwise are about such things as what the variables are in the causal claims, just what their possible values are, and even more importantly, just what is being claimed about how changing the cause variable from one of its values to another leads to a change in the effect variable. So here's an illustration. It's going to be a controversial one, but it's actually one that is discussed by a number of people in the econometrics and statistics literature. So consider this claim here. Being a woman causes one to be discriminated against in hiring. Interventionists, or people who believe that it helps to associate causal claims with hypothetical experiments, are inclined to regard claims like this as unclear and to think that they can be made clearer or disambiguated by making it explicit just which claim about the outcome of a hypothetical experiment is intended. And in particular, from an interventionist perspective, the basic problem with a claim like being a woman causes you to be discriminated against in hiring is that the notion of a manipulation or an intervention on gender or being a woman is unclear, or at least there are a number of different things that might be met by this, and you want to sort of sort out what it is that you have in mind. So, for example, one possible way of manipulating gender is to change the structure of an individual's sex chromosomes immediately after conception. Interpreted in this way, the claim that being a woman causes you to be discriminated against might be understood as claiming that such an intervention would change someone's probability of being hired for certain jobs. So the hypothetical experiment here that sort of makes clearer the meaning of claim 3 is something like if you were to switch chromosomes immediately after conception that would affect probability of being hired for certain jobs. That's one possible construal of three, but here's another one which I think comes closer to capturing what most of those asserting a claim like three intend to mean or intend to claim, and this is that intervening to change an employer's beliefs about the gender of an applicant will change that person's probability of being hired. So here you're really envisioning a different hypothetical experiment. I won't go into detail about why I think that this is the more plausible construal of the original claim, but I think that it is. The point that I want to emphasize in particular, though, is that if you think that this second claim, manipulating someone's beliefs will change, the employer's beliefs will change the probability of a certain kind of hiring decision, then you're thinking of the relevant variable as not so much gender as something like the beliefs of the employer about the gender of the person that you're intending to hire. And this is one illustration, it seems to me, about of how it is that the interventionist framework forces one to be more precise about which variables are involved in the causal relationship. It's surely clear, if nothing else, that those two alternative construals of the claim about the role of gender in discrimination in hiring, the one that envisions manipulation of chromosomes and the other which associates it with a hypothetical experiment that manipulates the employer's beliefs, these are surely two different causal claims. And by distinguishing among them, we can make the original causal claim, I contend, clearer. Okay, here's another issue about the role of interventionist thinking, and this is my attempt to answer the complaint that at least in context in which you can't actually do the experiment, the account is unilluminating. So I should perhaps say that I think of the remarks that I just made about clarifying the meaning of a causal claim by associating with this or that hypothetical experiment as an attempt to explain how one can say how it is that the connection between causal claims and hypothetical experiments can be illuminating and helpful without being reductive, and so it's an attempt to capture how it is that these people who think that the connection is illuminating, what it is that must be going on in their minds. Now, I'll say also, I don't have time to get into this, that I suspect that there's a sort of psychological dimension to the connection too that is worth further exploration. My guess is that part of what goes on when you associate a causal claim with a hypothetical experiment is that you're accessing information that is perhaps available to you only in some sort of tacit form, or at least it's not readily available for explicit consideration or something like that, and you're making it more explicit, and that's part of the reason why you think, as I think many people do, that you've actually learned something when you associate a causal claim with a hypothetical experiment. So getting back to the issue about testing procedures and how the interventionist framework helps with these and how it casts some light on what good testing procedures would be like, even in contexts in which you can't actually do an experiment. The basic idea here, of course, is that what one is trying to do is, if one is in a context in which one has non-experimental data, is you're trying to infer from that data what the results of a hypothetical experiment would be without actually doing the experiment in question. As I'll try to illustrate, I think this is an idea that, contrary to what you might initially suppose, has a genuine methodological bite, because what it does is to tell you that you can evaluate proposed inference procedures on the basis of whether they provide evidence that allows you to draw conclusions about the the outcomes of hypothetical experiments. Certain kinds of inference procedures do pretty well when evaluated in this way. So-called instrumental variables or regression discontinuity designs are kind of naturally understood in this framework, whereas other sorts of inferential procedures do much less well. Now, I just have time for an illustration, one illustration involving instrumental variables. And very, very quickly, here's the idea. Suppose we're faced with a situation which we want to estimate a coefficient B in a regression context. And we face the problem that the error term U is correlated with the independent variable X. So it's an elementary result that the simplest way of estimating the value of the coefficient B in this sort of context, that is by using ordinary least squares, is going to lead to a biased estimator. So if U is correlated with X, standard OLS estimation techniques aren't going to work. The question is there some other way in contexts like this in which you can reliably estimate that coefficient B? And the answer is yes, if you can find an instrumental variable. What's an instrumental variable? Well, it's a variable Z, which is, first of all, associated with the independent variable X, and it's correlated with X. It's independent of U, the error term, and it's conditionally independent of Y, given X and U. And when these conditions are satisfied, it's widely accepted that you can use the instrumental variable to estimate the value of the coefficient B. And if you can even, you can do this in such a way that B, you have reason to think, has a causal interpretation. That is, it really does tell you in this sort of context what the result of a hypothetical experiment would be in which you manipulate X. So you can just get the value of B just from covariational information having to do with Y, X, and Z. Now, why is it that this works? Why does instrumental variables work? Well, here's the standard story. This is not what I'm making up. This is what econometricians say. They say that when you have an instrumental variable, the instrument Z functions in a way that, in effect, is intervention-like in its relation to the independent variable X with respect to the dependent variable Y. In particular, Z behaves like a so-called soft intervention. And really what's going on here is that the structure of the situation is such that any variation in Z, which is associated with Y, given that that Z really does behave as an instrument, must be due to the causal influence of X on Y rather than being due to some other source, such as a confounding variable. So what you're doing here is you're evaluating the use of instrumental variables by thinking of them as attempts to provide reliable information about what you would get in an experiment, even though you can't actually do the experiment. Instrumental variables are widely acknowledged to be a particularly reliable way of doing causal inference when you're dealing with non-experimental data, and I think the interventionist framework makes sense of this. How much time do I have left? What?
You have
10 minutes. Oh, okay, good. Okay, so I think it's just not right that, as was claimed in that second critique, that an interventionist take on causation has nothing relevant to say to issues about testing or causal inference. Okay, I want to conclude by talking a little bit about the notion of a possible intervention. This is an issue that has puzzled me, and I don't think that what I have to say about it is really very adequate, but let me get some ideas out on the table and maybe you can help me out. So recall that condition M that connects causal claims and interventions, and the first clause there says that it has to be possible to intervene on X. And one question that the use of this first clause raises is, of course, what's meant by possible. I don't have a very adequate story about this, but perhaps something like the following are necessary conditions anyway. Something has to at least meet these conditions if it's going to count as possible. You might think that the intervention in question at least has to make logical or conceptual sense. And secondly, you might think that the intervention has to be consistent with the laws of nature, so to speak, taken just by themselves. So if I'm contemplating an intervention that requires movement faster than light, then that doesn't qualify as possible. On the other hand, if I'm considering an intervention in some specific set of circumstances in which the conjunction of the initial conditions that characterize those circumstances and the laws of nature make the intervention impossible, maybe that's okay, and maybe not. But anyway, these strike me as just candidates for what might be meant as possible. But apart from the question of how we're going to characterize the relevant notion of possibility here, you might think that there's a prior issue, and this is that you might think that any reference at all to the intervention being possible in the condition M is pretty obviously misguided. And the thought is something like this: shouldn't whether X causes Y depend just on whatever intrinsic relationship holds between X and Y? Whether interventions on X are possible, on the other hand, seems extrinsic to the character of the X-Y relation, or so our intuitions seem to tell us. So if that's right, then it's inappropriate to include this condition in the characterization that connects interventions and causation. And in particular, you might think, for example, that putting that first condition, which makes reference to the possibility of intervening into condition M, really gives you at best a kind of characterization of something like a condition for controllability of Y by X rather than a condition for X causing Y. And Tim Maudlin, in particular, in his book on the interpretation of quantum mechanics, has pushed the line that these are really very different concepts. Controllability and causation come apart, and presumably they come apart exactly because, at least according to Tim, you can have a causal relationship between X and Y even when there's no possibility, in some strong sense of no possibility, of actually manipulating or changing X. So pursuing this line of thought, you might think that what you should do is just, first of all, you might just drop the reference to possible interventions in the characterization M. Or you might go further. If you're going to drop the reference to possible interventions, why not go further and just drop any reference to interventions at all? Why not just talk about counterfactuals, the antecedents of which are made true by miracles or something like that. Alexander Reutlinger, in a recent paper, Getting Rid of Interventions, advocates doing just this. Or you might perhaps propose something like this: C causes E if and only if C is part of a set of conditions occurring at some time T prior to E that non-redundantly suffice nomologically for E. There's no reference to interventions or possible interventions here at all. Now, I don't deny that there's a certain attractiveness in trying to get rid of the notion of an intervention in this way, but I also want to suggest to you that all of these proposals are potentially problematic exactly because they do dispense with something like the first clause in M, the one that makes reference to possible interventions. And there are lots of examples, I think, that might be used to illustrate this, but I'm going to just make a very quick reference to one, and this is the same thing that Hugh talked about, causation in EPR-type setups. So you recall the standard setup: there are two entangled particles, they're emitted from a source, they're allowed to get at space-like separation. We perform a measurement on one of the particles, particle one, maybe we measure spin in the x direction, and the result, of course, of the a measurement on particle one conveys information about the spin direction, the result of a spin direction measurement on particle two. And this is because the spins of the two particles are correlated, and furthermore, there isn't going to be any candidate for a common cause that satisfies any plausible locality condition. There's not going to be any common cause that screens off the two measurement results from one another that's in the intersection of the backward light cone of the two. Now, you would then raise the question, which is frequently discussed in the philosophy of science literature, does the state of particle one found on measurement, that is the measurement outcome, cause the measurement outcome on particle two? And lots of theories of causation, Lewis's original theory, the accounts that I mentioned above that drop the reference to manipulation or intervention on the cause being possible, all of them seem to suggest that there is a causal connection in this case. The measurement outcome on particle two is counterfactually dependent on the measurement outcome on particle one. There's a non-redundant nomologically sufficient relationship here, et cetera, et cetera. So if there's causal connection between the two particles, as these accounts of causation seem to suggest, then of course we have superluminal causation between the separated particles. There's at least an apparent tension with special relativity, and of course, in addition, this alleged causal relationship has some pretty odd features. It's symmetric rather than asymmetric, doesn't attenuate with distance, and so on and so forth. I think it's an attractive feature of interventionism that allows us to resist the conclusion or the claim that the measurement outcome on particle one causes the measurement outcome on particle two, or at least it allows us to resist this conclusion if we're willing to say, as is generally supposed, that intervention on the measurement outcome on particle one is not something that's possible. So if we have this clause one in RM insisting that it, for X to cause Y, it has to be possible to intervene on X, then we avoid the problem in question. So in this case, at least, M, with both the clauses 1 and 2 retained, seems to me to yield what intuitively many people would say is the right causal judgment. Now, of course, it is true that you can intervene on the measurement apparatus by deciding to measure spin, say in the x direction, rather than to make some other type of measurement. And of course, if it were possible by choosing to measure spin in the x direction rather than the y direction on particle one, one could manipulate the measurement outcome in the x direction for particle two, then according to M itself, you would have superluminal causation. This would be a so-called act-outcome correlation. But as we know, the empirical evidence and certainly conventional understanding of quantum mechanics suggests that this isn't possible. You can't, by manipulating what's going on one of the wings of the apparatus, affect what's going on the other wing of the apparatus. Now, it's true, of course, that there is a relationship between the state of particle one and the state of particle two. Indeed, they're entangled or they're in a non-separable state. But according to the interventionist framework, this relationship of non-separability or entanglement shouldn't be regarded as a causal relationship, precisely because it's not exploitable for purposes of manipulation and control. It has some other status. Maybe it's better described as passion at a distance rather than action at a distance, as Abner Shimoni has suggested. So to generalize the moral, what I want to suggest here is that one of the attractions of interventionism with that first clause in M is that it seems to me to allow us to distinguish causal relationships from other sorts of relationships that involve kinds of dependence or relatedness, as in the APR experiment, that are not causal. If we drop this clause one, I think we end up with a criterion for causation that's overly broad. It includes non-causal as well as causal varieties of relatedness, and I think the APR experiment illustrates this. So I think I'll just stop at this point. Thank you very much for listening.